Welcome to our listeners. My name is Yusuf Sufi. I'm a co-PI for the Reading Muslims Project at the Institute of Islamic Studies, University of Toronto. The Reading Muslims Project is funded by the Cannot Global Challenge grant. And today we are very fortunate to have with us Dr. Enver Iman. I'll begin with a land acknowledgement and then introduce Dr. Iman and introduce his book, Jurisdictional Exceptionalisms, Islamic Law, International Law, and Parental Child Abduction, written with Irfan Khalik. So we wish to acknowledge this land on which the University of Toronto operates. For thousands of years, it has been the traditional land of the Huron-Wendat, the Seneca, and the Mississaugas of the Credit. Today, this meeting place is still the home to many Indigenous people across Turtle Island, and we are grateful to have the opportunity to work on this land. All right, let me now introduce Dr. Iman. Enver Iman is Professor of Law and History, Canada Research Chair in Islamic Law and History, and Director of the Institute of Islamic Studies at the University of Toronto. He is author of several books, including Natural Law Theories in Islam and Religious Pluralism and Islamic Law, Dhimmis and Others in the Empire of Law. He is also editor of several books, including Islamic Law and International Human Rights Law, edited alongside Mark Ellis and Benjamin Glahn. He's here today to discuss with me his latest book, co-authored with Irfan Khalik of Cardiff University, entitled Jurisdictional Exceptionalisms, Islamic Law, International Law, and Parental Child Abduction. Now, let me say a few words about the book before I turn it over to our esteemed guest, Dr. Iman. So, Enver Iman and Irfan Khalik's book focuses on the Hague Convention, on the civil aspects of child abduction, commonly referred to as the Hague Abduction Convention. The book is a rare feat insofar as it combines historical study of pre-modern Islamic law with contemporary analysis of private international law, providing insight into the ways that Muslim jurists' positions, around jurisdiction and child custody impact the successes and failures of contemporary international treaties on child custody and parental abduction across borders. One of the main themes we will be discussing today is the concept of cadastral jihad, the notion that jurists were highly influenced by imperial laws around war and peace when deriving rules for how the law should operate across international borders. Enver, welcome to this podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Enver, I want to begin by giving you the opportunity to describe the main project of the book to our listeners. In particular, can you tell us what the Hague Abduction Convention is? Are Muslim states party to this convention? And what do you and Khalik mean when you use the term Islamic exceptionalism? Can you also tell us what prompted you and Khalik to begin to work on this project?
Sure. Well, I'll maybe start with the last one. The last question is, I was approached by the Canadian government in 2009 to help them think about issues of mediation in Islamic law, because what was then Malta III, where the Hague Conference and a private international law organization and member states come together to talk about issues of private international law, particularly around parental child abduction, discussions at Malta III fell apart precisely because many Muslim countries that had not joined the Hague Abduction Convention were tired of being told that that's what they must do. So what ended up happening at Malta III was that Canada and the government of Pakistan agreed to co-chair what they called a mediation working group, and that would focus on alternative strategies, though it's not clear that the Hague Abduction Convention was ever very far from their imagination. And the idea was, how might we think about resolving questions when one parent absconds with children to another country, leaving a left behind parent in what is often called the state of habitual residence of those children. And so we were asked to contribute over time to the larger project around mediation, the smaller project around mediation. And then towards the end of that, around 2013, 2014, I was asked once again to do a more robust study to really address why do Muslim countries not join the Hague Abduction Convention? Now, the Hague Abduction Convention was drafted in 1979 and promulgated in 1980 by the Hague Conference. The Hague Conference is a multilateral organization that specializes in what's called private international law, an aspect of international law, really around conflicts between jurisdictions and things like that. And what the Hague Abduction Convention did was that it created what was called the automatic return provision, that where two parties are members of the convention and a parent absconds from one state to another, both of which are members are parties to the convention, then the receiving country, the country of refuge, when they hear the case and realize this is an abduction case that's covered by the convention, the court there says, we must return this child to the habitual residence because the courts over there have jurisdiction to decide the underlying conflict. We do not. So that's the basic idea around the convention. And as it turns out, many countries are signatory to this convention in Europe, North America, the Commonwealth. But as it turns out, a number of countries are not. And they have historically been black holes where parents could abscond with little consequences. It used to be Japan was one of these black holes. It's since joined the convention and has altered its frameworks. But Muslim majority states, particularly those that apply Islamic family law, remain a point of ongoing concern. Oftentimes they're not members of the Hague Conference as a whole, and so they're not participating in the regime of private international law from that agency. Or they might be members, but they refuse to join this particular convention. So the challenge was, what's precluding them from doing so? And so that sort of gives you the sense of why we undertook this study, what the Hague Abduction Convention is, as to why Muslim countries don't join. The conventional literature, like the secondary literature, suggests that it's an issue of human rights. It's an issue of a lack of children's rights in the Muslim world, or it's a failure of Muslim jurisdictions to prioritize the standard of best interests of the child, which is a dominant argument, even though most of these countries have joined the Convention on the Rights of Children from, I believe, 1990. What Orfan and I realized instead was that what's actually happening here is a failure to meet on issues of jurisdiction. And jurisdiction in this context plays out in different ways. And so, you know, to really conclude by addressing your last question around Islamic exceptionalism, once we realized that what was happening was a failure to communicate effectively on jurisdiction, what we realized was all these different states, European and Muslim majority states, were basically agreeing to the same ideas, but really talking past one another. They don't have the same notion of jurisdiction at play. And so when we thought about, well, how do Muslim majority countries understand their engagement with international law generally and the abduction convention issues more specifically, what we realized was a type of Islamic exceptionalism. In this case, not in the kind of American and European exceptionalism that we oftentimes see in a much broader way, but in the case of Islamic law, many Muslim majority states, when they join international conventions, will limit the scope of their ratification. They'll put restrictions, conditions, and declarations that limit what they understand to be the application of certain provisions. In many cases, those limitations are defined as a deference to Sharia, but they never define what Sharia is. Sharia then operates as a type of trump card that operates exceptionally to exempt Muslim countries from what otherwise would be the normal application of these international treaties. And there's an interesting way in which the case of international child abduction and the way Muslim majority countries understand jurisdiction perpetuates this notion of a kind of Islamic exceptionalism. And that's what we mean by Islamic exceptionalism and the way Sharia is positioned in modern states relative to international treaties to create a special carve out without expressly defining what it is and what it means.
Okay, so just a quick follow up. So is this notion of Islamic exceptionalism, is it one that through your research on this study and other studies relating to human rights, is it a prejudice, like assumptions about Sharia, or is it one that you find is actually there empirically?
Well, what we argue is the reason that these countries are all talking past one another is they both employ exceptionalisms of their own. Mm. So in, as an example, one of the interesting things about the Hague Abduction Convention that we uncovered was that there was early on a debate among the drafters as to whether or not included in the conventions should be what's called a public order exception. The idea here would be that a state could refuse to return a child to the habitual state of reference if in doing so, it would subject the children to laws in that home jurisdiction that violate the state of refuge's core principles and values, constitutional and otherwise. It was actually the state of Denmark that initiated this conversation, followed by Italy. Now, keep in mind, at the drafting, there were only two Muslim-majority countries present, Morocco and Egypt. And it's hard not to imagine the Danish representative talking directly at the Moroccan representative. As I'm reading the transcripts and I'm reading the travaux préparatoires, the working documents, it's clear that the Danish representative was thinking about Muslim majority countries and their failure to account for best interests of the child, automatically transfer custody to one parent over another based on few considerations of the child. Interestingly, shortly in the minutes of that day, the Moroccan representative said, I too agree we should have a public order exception as well, as if not to be outdone by the Northern European. And so one can't help but think that this idea of a public order exception took shape in this concern around Islamic law. Now, in the deliberations, the discussion on public order, the vote on public order exceptions suggested that there was not a majority that favored it. In fact, to put this exception into the convention might preclude broad signing in and accession to the convention. The vote broke down as follows, is to actually have a public order exception as an optional reservation or as an optional element that countries can opt into when they join the convention. So it's not part of the convention, but you can add it in if you so choose. Strangely enough, Article 20 is the public order exception in the Hague Abduction Convention, and there's no explanation as to how it got in. All that we know is that it hasn't been used very often, and therefore indicates that it has very little teeth, according to most commentators. Our argument, however, is that for now it has very little teeth, but if you increase membership in this convention to Muslim majority countries, is it possible that public order will be used to justify not returning children to these countries? And so what we did was we looked at how do contemporary states in non-Hague convention cases treat Muslim jurisdictions. And quite often they have a number of biases about Islamic law and Muslim majority states that preclude them from ever returning these children. And so we inquired, what would happen if this same analysis was done under an Article 20 framework if both parties, both states were party to the convention? And we found enough evidence to suggest that the same thing would happen, that we would see Article 20 become the thin edge of the wedge to effectively perform a kind of European exceptionalism or North Atlantic exceptionalism to the denigration of Muslim majority states. Now, that's one form of exceptionalism that we find. The other exceptionalism is on the other side, in the Muslim majority states too. They have an exceptionalism that's no less the case. And if you look at if you look in our chapter 5, we try to outline how did Muslim jurists imagine taking jurisdiction? And what we find is that there are three different examples of what we might call conflicts of law. In contractual matters that came from outside the Dar al-Islam, they would say, a lot depends on whether the contract has been fully executed. If it has not been fully executed, it poses enough nexus to our jurisdiction, we'll take the case. There's extraterritorial application of Islamic law on Muslims from the Dar al-Islam who are perhaps visiting the Dar al-Harb, the abode of what we call the dominion of non-Islam. And what we end up showing is that in that case, it varies and vacillates, but a lot depends on where you want to impose the law and who has the authority and whether we need to wait to return back to the home jurisdiction. But when it came to family law cases, if a marital couple from outside the dominion of Islam comes to the dominion of Islam for whatever reason, and all of a sudden files a case with the local qadi, the qadi will ask, are these folks Muslim? If they're not, and their marriage was contracted into outside, the courts will not take jurisdiction and will tell them to go back home and figure it out in their courts. But the moment one party converts to Islam, khalas, then what we see is the courts, the Muslim courts will take jurisdiction and apply Islamic law. This is important. They're collapsing personal jurisdiction over the parties and a choice of law, Sharia. They don't care what the foreign law might be. Now, fast forward to the modern Muslim state, in which most areas of law are informed by a variety of sources, except for personal status law, al-ahwal al-shakhsiyya, family law. What we find is, though there is not the same express statement of jurisdiction in family law cases, effectively, what we see is Muslim majority states and their courts, when they apply the statutes of family law, they're importing this medieval family law status rule. As if, and you know, there's something to be said about this. For comparative law scholars, they see this status-based rule and say, oh, this is the only rule of jurisdiction that Islamic law has ever had. Well, that's not true, but that is a dominant view in much comparative law today. But what we suggest is that this particular status-based jurisdictional rule, when applied by Muslim majority states, operates as a kind of Islamic exceptionalism, not unlike the public order exception in Article 20, if it were in, let's say, the UK or France or elsewhere. And that Islamic exceptionalism taking shape through jurisdiction allows for us to see these states, European and Muslim majority, never quite meeting each other in the case of how do we understand jurisdiction in these cases. And that's where Islamic exceptionalism, that's where the two exceptionalisms come to bat. And that's why we title the book Jurisdictional Exceptionalisms, plural, because there's not just one happening here. They're happening on both sides of the equation.
Well, let's explore a little bit the Islamic exceptionalism, because that's where a lot of the heavy lifting of the book takes place. There's mm-hmm. a historical uncovering of kind of the roots of the Islamic exceptionalism. So let's take a look at that in a bit more depth. You say that pre-modern Islamic law understood custody through two concepts. One is wilaya and the other is hidana. What do these two concepts mean? And how are they related to custody? What do they tell us about Muslim jurists' concern for a child's interests or well-being?
No, that's a fair enough question. So I should preface this by saying, why is a chapter on custody in the book at all? And part of the reason we add this chapter in is because the dominant Euro-American view of Islamic family law is that it does not have a best interest of the child standard. At most, it's now read in because these countries have now adopted the Convention on the Rights of the Child, oftentimes without any reservation, and that convention is all about best interests of the child. And what we wanted to say, both to the Danish representative back in 1979 and contemporary authors on this issue and advocates, expert witnesses in these cases, is that it's not enough to simply say Islamic law as it stands in terms of custody rules doesn't account for best interests. What we need to do is understand what animates the medieval historical rules that we have found and that then get applied into modern day statutes. So we then spent chapter 4 of the book uncovering what exactly was the logic of rules of custody. And oftentimes when we look at the literature on this aspect, we see it framed in terms of gender. you know, what are the rights of mothers and fathers relative to their children? What we realize is that a feminist analysis or a gender-based analysis isn't enough. That while we need to incorporate gender as a useful category of analysis, we also need to include children as another category of analysis, because it explains some of the moves that jurists were making, whether we agree with them now or not, but it does explain what they were doing. So number one, we know that historically custody was divided between wilaya and hedana. Wilaya really having to do with the financial oversight of children, their management and their care. Hedana being a form of custodial care. Wilaya as a concept oftentimes has to do with issues of property, management and oversight of property. Management and oversight almost as an agent for someone else, right? But children are not property. Children are a unique item, and we need to think about them not as property, not as an item at all, but in fact as human beings that need a certain kind of custodial care, hence hedana. There's no doubt from a gendered perspective, we should note that wilaya and hedana operate in a hierarchy with wilaya at the top and hedana below. At the same time, what we find is the jurists arguing with respect to physical custody, who has the greater right over it and why? When it comes to financial accountability, who must pay and why? And what we found in these analyses is that yes, jurists did talk about custody residing primarily with the mother until the children turned a certain age, and then presumptively that custody shifting at that age to the father. But these were presumptions. The question was, what could defeat the presumptions? And what we found was that whereas most Muslim states today adopt these strict rules of allocation of custody to one parent or another, subject to the age of the child, what we find is that the age was doing something heuristically for the jurists. The age was signaling at what point does the court need to consider what the child wants. And there is then a big discussion around tahir. Does the child have the ability to choose at that age? Before that age, they're deemed not to have that capacity. At that age and after, they're deemed to have control, some choice, some voice. And this shouldn't be surprising to lawyers today. We oftentimes have the same debate around when can we discuss these matters with children? When can we put a child on the stand? And when we are putting a child on the stand, what kind of protections must we put on them, put in the situation to protect them, their privacy, their confidentiality, and their well-being in that context? Because testifying can be quite intimidating. So we have these conversations today. They have them in the medieval period. And what custody rules suggest to us is that consistently in delineating between who has an obligation to pay, who has an obligation to care, yes, on the one hand, there were clear gendered ideals that they were transposing onto these doctrines. We might disagree with those gendered ideals. But we also found that these gendered ideals were in the service of what jurists called hadha al-walad, the well-being of the child. And that was integral for us. That was key for us to find. We didn't know we would find it, but what we realized was that this myth of Islamic law not having a best interest of the child standard reflected a fundamental failure among scholars, writers, and others in the contemporary age to read these sources and to understand that at the heart of them, it's not the holding or the black letter law that always should matter. It's the rationale given and the worldview these jurists were imposing and the feature of the child as the figure that has to be also included in the legal calculus, not just the parents. And that was the key. That was key for us in suggesting that what we're finding and what we're having to respond to is an embedded bias against Muslim law, but it's a bias that Muslim majority states today perpetuate precisely because they mimic these laws, they integrate these laws without oftentimes looking at the tradition themselves. So it's not exactly one side's fault or the other. There's a participatory process here in which all sides are involved in this reification of this image of Islamic law. And our hope is to have corrected that to some degree.
But there is a way in which these states are applying Islamic law, if we could say faithfully, if there is such an application of the past and the present, which is around geographical jurisdiction, right? One of the things that your book does is to take a look at how international law is from the past is imagined, and how this carries over today. So one of the contentions is that judges in Muslim states that apply Islamic family law are beholden, likely unknowingly, to imperial assumptions that existed at the time when Islamic family law was first drafted or first developed by jurists. You use this notion of cadastral jihad to speak of these assumptions. Can you tell us more about this concept? What is cadastral jihad?
Yeah, no.
And you may want to focus a bit on the term cadastral in your answer, just because I needed to Google it. So some of our readers might not be familiar with it. It's this concept from cartography, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's correct.
So tell us a bit about it and its relevance and the relevance of this imperial legacy in parental abduction cases today.
Absolutely. So on the one hand, we know that there has been a legal doctrine of jihad in Islamic law. And that legal doctrine divided the world between the Dar al-Islam, the Dar al-Harb. And most have translated those terms as the abode of Islam and the abode of war, reinforcing the kind of militaristic sensibility of this legal regime. We chose to translate it as dominion of Islam and dominion of non-Islam for two reasons. One, we didn't believe that what was animating the jurisdictional rules was militaristicness. So we wanted to undermine that assumption in the way we translated the terms. We also wanted to use terms like dominion of Islam and non-Islam to emphasize the idea of boundary. And boundaries are most notably marked on maps being the product of cartography. Now, Richard Ford of Stanford University Law School has argued that the idea of jurisdiction is a modern notion because you cannot have jurisdiction without modern scientific cartography in the scientific revolution. And we, of course, completely disagree with him. We disagree with Ford in saying that because we show that you can actually see in these various rules of jurisdiction in medieval Islam a way by which Muslims are mapping space administratively. And so when we talk about cadastral as opposed to cartographic, we don't use cartography. We could have called it cartographic jihad, and that might have been more obvious to our readers. But there's something very specific about cadastral that we wanted to make clear and we wanted to emphasize. Cadastres that still exist today are the kinds of maps that delineate private property lines between you and your neighbors. They're created by the state for various administrative purposes. We oftentimes think of them, and they oftentimes come into play only when there's a private law dispute between two private individual homeowners. And so in many ways, people don't think of these as state-based maps. They think of them as supporting individual private litigation. But they are state-based maps. They're created by the state. They administer the state. They map the state for purposes of a series of legal relations between individuals and otherwise. And so cadastral jihad is our attempt to think about how the ideas of jihad around the us and the them, the dominion of Islam, the dominion of non-Islam, the border that defines the two, actually has jurisdictional implications, is really about law and lawmaking and the capacity to speak the law. And so we used cadastral jihad to identify what exactly are these jurisdictional rules mapping. And so we first ask, well, let's first think about how the dominion of Islam is mapped. And what we did was we decided to follow a single doctrine. There is a doctrine on these jurisdictional rules called Kitab al-Qadi ila al-Qadi, when one judge writes a decree of some sort to another judge in another jurisdiction. In other words, we want to follow the paper, follow the documents. Where does one document go? What is the impact and legal implication of one judge's writing on another judge in a completely different jurisdiction? It does raise issues of wilaya. What is the authority of a judge to adjudicate? Most documents, most sources suggest that a judge adjudicates pursuant to a walaya issued to him from the Imam al-Adl, the just imam, where as a condition of these valid walayas, you must indicate space, territory around which you adjudicate. So we began to address, well, what's the impact of these, you know, why do we care about this Kitab al-Qadi, Ila al-Qadi? Well, jurists said, look, the reality is that access to justice requires us to be able to give effect to these kinds of judicial writings across jurisdictional lines. The parties may not always reside in the same jurisdiction. Evidence may be in different jurisdictions. We need to be able to have this exchange of information between courts, even though it's crossing jurisdictional lines. There's a access to justice concern for the parties and the litigants. So that's number one. But number two, we also have to monitor how much force these have out of respect for the walaya each judge exercises. So one example that jurists have is, can a judge in one jurisdiction adjudicate the case by writing his decision while traveling out of his jurisdiction? And you would assume for efficiency purposes, of course he can, but as it turned out, he couldn't. That the moment you step out of your jurisdiction, you no longer have the power of a judge to adjudicate. Your writing, when dispatched from outside your jurisdiction, has no force or effect. Now, this is doctrinal. This isn't in actual practice. And you might say this is highly inefficient, but it's very effective in the absence of cartography to map space. So that's within the dominion of Islam. We also find that there was a debate as to what about the Kitab al-Qadi from the areas held by the Bughat, the rebels, which suggests a number of things. One, there is no singular Dar al-Islam. Dar al-Islam is punctured and punctuated by a certain diversity and instability presented by the rebels, but it doesn't mean that the rebel judges are necessarily ignored. It doesn't necessarily mean that their writings are ignored, but it does suggest that the space rebels occupy creates a concern and consideration for purposes of what is the value of that kitab from that judge. So that's the dominion of Islam. What happens when you start getting kitabs from outside, or you start dealing with the dominion of non-Islam? Well, what's fascinating is a Qadash al-Jihad model suggests, well, can there be law outside? If it's based on jihad, and jihad is based upon the righteous sovereignty of the Muslim and the righteousness of Islam as a universal tradition, then the question really is, if there's law outside, is it any good inside the dominion of Islam? And what we find from the Hanafis to the Malikis and other is the law in the dominion of non-Islam is not law at all. It's bad law. It's not great law. It's maybe just duress and coercion. It is, in fact, the land of legal barbarity, if we're to say anything. And so there is no kitab from outside that really matters. We think of this in terms of amans, like requests for permission to travel and then enter. But what we find then is that if there's no law outside there, then the moment parties from out in the dominion of non-Islam enter the Dar al-Islam, and they appear before the court, what law is a Qadi's court supposed to apply? Now, it might very well be that if there's a contract, it's a document, we can review it. But the concerns that jurors at first asked is, do we even hear the case? Must we hear the case at all? And a lot depended on what were the conditions of the activity, who were the parties, what was the nature of the legal dispute. That's number one. But number two is, what law should we apply? And it was never not Islamic law. It was always going to be Islamic law, especially in family law cases. The issue was more oftentimes, when would it apply, when would it not apply? But not that it wouldn't apply, and rather we the Muslim court would apply some other law. That was never the case. So this becomes the way in which we see the law, and jurisdictionally we see the law in service of an imperial imagination, not necessarily militarily effected in any way, but certainly imagined through the language of jihad and mapped across space cadastrally, so as to effectively administer law where necessary. And that's what cadastral jihad is really meant to try to capture, the non-militaristic sensibility of jihad as it affects the administration of justice and the imagination of law, not from outside the dominion of Islam, and whether or not, in fact, law exists out there at all. We note with some irony that in many ways, what Muslim jurists imagined as bad law out there reflects a lot of 19th and 20th century European images of Islamic law that we now call Orientalist. It reflects the kind of the same logic of the capitulation agreements in the Ottoman Empire, or in the case of China, the United States creating the US District Court of Shanghai on the assumption that Chinese law is bad. So there is, as Teimur Rescola calls, a 19th and 20th century legal Orientalism that we can talk about. And so ironically, we see a similar dynamic among Muslim jurists thinking jihadly about space and jurisdiction and law. But we don't go too far with that other than to note it.
And part of your argument is that this has impacted contemporary Muslim states. Is that correct?
Yeah, so our argument then, and this is where, you know, we need to appreciate that in many ways, this particular book is directed at lawyers, judges, advocates, parent advocates. But for Islamic legal studies, my hope is that we see this as a way of thinking across time periods. We chose to approach a problem in the world that we found. That problem happened to also integrate a historical analysis of Islamic law as part of our diagnosis. But it's not just the past that matters. It's the way that past then gets integrated in the modern state. And we know in Islamic legal studies, there is a narrative pushed forward by Al-Halaq and others that there is no Islamic law, or the impossible state makes Islamic law impossible. And I would argue rather, as a historian, we can find traces of Islamic law throughout contemporary practice across different regions. One of those areas is family law. You might disagree with whether the form of the code transforms it or not. I don't really care if you think that or not. The fact of the matter is we see these traces, we see these references, we see medieval Islamic law used as a kind of resource, a kind of jurisprudential common law that fills in legislative gaps, statutory gaps. Our view is that while Muslim majority states have no qualm in playing playfully with jurisdiction, when it comes to Islamic family law, they effectively import willy-nilly, I don't think intentionally, but willy-nilly, they import the medieval Islamic status-based family law rule of jurisdiction. So we offer as an example, for instance, the Dubai International Financial Center as an example of playful jurisdiction. There, if you want to engage in banking, real estate, or other sorts of transactions, the currency, the default currency is the US dollar. The relevant law is London financial law. The adjudicatory body is the DIFC court, not a UAE court, not a Dubai court. And there's a way in which the DIFC as a space, physical space in Dubai, creates its own, has and occupies an exceptional jurisdictional space, applying a law not of the UAE. And so not unlike the free trade zones that we see in that part of the world, so too the DIFC. In this case, the DIFC and other similar kinds of endeavors have helped create Dubai into the international financial center it has become. But when it comes to family law, personal status law, the law of the UAE classifies it as informing its own notion of public order, or what it calls Nidham al-Aam. Not unlike we see in the UK and others, human rights law, a certain kind of liberal notion of human rights will inform its notion of public order and preclude automatic return to Muslim majority states. So what does this mean? This means that by integrating family law as public order, by effectively importing this medieval status-based conflicts of law rule into their application, we see the same game in Muslim countries being played out, this kind of Sharia-based exceptionalism in this narrow area of family law, as we're beginning to see in the bastions of so-called liberal democratic human rights like London and others. And we actually show in a case by Baroness Hale, of the then House of Lords in the UK that in fact she would read the European Court of the European Convention of Human Rights into Article 20 to preclude return of a child from Saudi Arabia back to Saudi Arabia. She would do that. And so we're seeing the same dynamic on both sides of the equation.
Gotcha. Can you finish, Enver, by telling us some of the implications of your study for the application of international law across jurisdictions? What do you see as the future of cooperation between states over parental child abduction cases? And how have policymakers responded to your analysis of the limitations of the Hague Abduction Convention?
Well, so I think, you know, my one of the books that you mentioned that I edited was this book called Islamic Law and International Human Rights Law, Searching for Common Ground. And that book, the title ended with a question mark because we oftentimes talk about common ground, but that book adopted a different position, is that we can't search for common ground before we clear ground. And what this book was, and one of the limitations of that edited collection was that by addressing human rights law, we were speaking at a level of abstraction around abstract rights, when most international law are these highly detailed, pedantic areas that most people ignore, frankly, you know, currency transfers or whatnot, right? And private international and parental child abduction is one of these very technical areas of international law. So what we knew is we wanted to see whether or not the clearing ground model would work in that context in a more specific area of international law. And what we've done is we've suggested that's in fact what has to happen, that if we actually want to understand the impasse on parental child abduction, we need to recognize this is not just a Muslim family law state problem. This is a global problem in the way states on all sides of the equation define public order, define what is and isn't a core value, and the implications of that public order on the exceptions they make in deference to it. This is as much a problem in Europe as it is a problem for Muslim majority states on this issue. And it means that we need to recognize that Article 20 remains a sore thumb in this convention. Now, I will be honest and tell you that nobody wants to hear that. Most people want to say Article 20 hasn't done anything. We don't need to worry about it. Most people don't want to think that, well, Article 20 doesn't create the problems you think about. But I believe they're wrong. I believe they're wrong. And I think as we think about what is the jurisprudence locally that will inform an Article 20 case, we need to think about this. Let's say I have Saudi Arabia and Germany as parties to the Hague Abduction Convention, and somebody absconds with a child to Germany from Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabian parent who's left behind demands automatic return under the Hague Abduction Convention. Well, the absconding party now in Germany can invoke Article 20. It's like, I know you, Germany, have an obligation to send us back, to send this child back. However, the conception of justice in Saudi Arabia is contrary to German notions of public order. And in order to figure out what Article 20 means in Germany, the German judge will have to look at domestic law on public order to give meaning to Article 20. Until there is greater clarity on what Article 20 means, that is the risk. And it threatens to upend the convention. So we conclude the book suggesting that maybe what we need is regional conventions. So Latin America has a regional parental of child abduction convention, because not all Latin American states are involved with the Hague Abduction Convention. Most of the parental abduction cases there are within the region, so they wanted to address a region-specific one. We suggest maybe a Muslim majority state, a Muslim family law state convention is in order, or maybe an optional protocol or protocol to the current Hague abduction focusing only on Muslim majority states is in order. It does create a separate entity, but it does allow us to account for the possibility that if child abduction cases are happening between North America and Europe and the Muslim world, they're most likely happening within the Muslim world as between different parties. We just don't have the data for it. So we suggest that. I will say that in terms of reactions to it, we've gotten a lot of really positive reaction from specialists in private international law. We've got a lot of wonderful reaction to it from parent advocacy groups advocating on issues around parental child abduction. And I think it's just, we hope it's a matter of time before it finds its way to the Hague Conference, to multilateral organizations as they think about how they want to resolve this problem. And, you know, recognizing that in some cases, the problem is the judiciary in these countries, how they're trained, whether they're integrated within the private international law training that marks the modern world or not. But we also need to recognize that as Europe and the United States engage in their own forms of exceptionalism, they're no less part of this problem too. And we need to rethink, therefore, how these various exceptionalisms operate. And nobody seems inclined to do that as of yet. So I'm not hopeful for short-term solutions, let's put it that way.
Thank you, Enver. It's always a pleasure. Enver Iman is professor of law and history at the University of Toronto. His book, written with Irfan Khalik, is Jurisdictional Exceptionalisms, Islamic Law, International Law, and Parental Child Abduction. Thank you again, Enver.
Thank you for having me.